And here we go again, time for another edition of Sundays with Shep here on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Ryan Priest, and every week at this time, we dig through the archives of Hammond's legendary radio raconteur, Gene Shepherd, in search of classic stories from Northwest Indiana and beyond. And while Gene Shepherd rarely took calls from listeners on his own program, when he sat in as a guest on other radio programs, he was sometimes forced to deal with the rabble out there. And we're going to open this week's program with a series of calls that he took as a guest of Long John Neble on his program on WNBC. And in this short segment, Shep takes calls on some of his favorite topics, which include the poetry of Robert W. Service, technical issues with radio signals, the difference between Hammond, Indiana and Calumet City, Illinois, and the never-ending mystery of does Shep actually prepare his shows or does he just open the mic and start talking? So with that, let's go back to December 24th, 1966, as originally aired on WNBC in New York. Gene Shepherd is a guest on Long John Neble's show on Sundays with Shep.
Hello.
Yeah, Shep, you're quite a fan of Robert Service, correct?
Well, I enjoy reading his poetry.
I have an LP that was made perhaps 8 years ago with Stuart Hamblin. Are you familiar with this
album? Yes, it's a terrible album.
Oh, you don't like it?
No, I think that he reads... I think he hokes up the poetry.
Oh, really? I didn't know whether you'd heard of it or not.
Yes, I don't like it at all.
Oh.
I think I read it much better than he does.
Yeah, I think you read it very well, but his, what about his background music and so forth? Do you like that?
Not particularly. I think it's corny.
Will you tell me what the fantastic QRM is on OR, Heterodyne, or whatever it is?
I have no idea. That must be some local condition around your neighborhood.
Every once in a while, and it's almost impossible.
You have it on the phone right now.
No.
I said you do.
No, it's much louder than that.
No, but I can hear it on
the
phone
now. I can hear it.
Now.
It's buzzing now on your phone.
You're talking about my voice.
No,
I'm not talking about your voice. I'm talking about some type of...
QRM.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's not on NBC. It's on OR.
No, it's on you.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye.
Hello.
Long John?
Yes, sir.
Gene, I have a few comments and a question. Number one, Tease at the Cops used to be pretty popular in Brooklyn around the 30s. And have you ever heard of it used there?
I presume it was. It had to be popular somewhere. I always used to see it in comic strips. I never heard it in life, though.
Yeah. We used to use it pretty often.
You play stickball out there, too?
What's that?
Did you play stickball in Brooklyn?
That's right.
That's where you heard it, right?
Right.
When the cops were coming, right?
You know, stickball was never played in Chicago.
No.
Oh, no?
No.
Oh, well, that was a poor man's game. You know?
Now, how many sores could you hit?
At least one and a half.
Okay,
two.
Fine.
And punch ball.
Off the stoop?
What's that?
Off the stoop.
And stoop ball, yeah.
And hit the penny.
Right.
Okay.
Right. I'm calling from the...
He's authentic.
Jersey.
He's all right. He's not a German agent.
What's your question, sir?
Okay. Question. How do the people in Hammond, Indiana, reconcile Calumet City right next door?
Well, Calumet City has changed a great deal. As a matter of fact, the old Calumet City, which was a hotbed of sin and vice and whatnot, has since become a middle-class, very respectable neighborhood. Did you know that?
No.
It's changed drastically.
I'll be darned.
And incidentally, you understand that reconciling Calumet City, the reason Calumet City was what it was over the state line. The people in Indiana couldn't do anything about it. It was in Illinois.
Yeah, but I mean, how can the people in Indiana look at all, buy all that whiskey and not try to change the situation in Indiana, you know?
Well, they did.
It went wet?
Well, I think you'll find that Indiana's changed. How long has it been since you've been out there?
Oh, about 5 years.
Well, things have changed.
Oh.
Drastically.
One more question, if I may. Some time ago, you had a program about keeping records on people, you know, through computers, and the fact that when a person made a mistake, you know, if he had a record, that would be held against him. Do you see a tendency towards this more and more now with, dropouts and what have you, and a danger here? You get the feeling that people are not making it really on their own. You have to follow a pattern, you know, formula, school, college, etc., etc. The old days, when I was a youngster, I never felt really that I was licked. You know, today I get the feeling that the teenagers, if they don't go to the right schools, they feel defeated. You think this is good?
Well, good or bad, it's there. I'm quite sure you're right, but I think this is a sociological question, as you could sit here and debate all night.
Yeah.
Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Hello.
Long John?
Yes, sir.
I'm calling from Huntington, West Virginia.
Good for you.
You're coming in loud and clear, Don.
So are you. Yeah, you're doing well, too.
Thank you. I'd like to ask Gene if he prepares his shows in advance at all, or...
I'm going to do. But the way it comes out is ad-libbed. In other words, it's like a jazz musician who will have, let's say he's going to improvise on T for Two. He knows the chord changes, and he knows the key, and he knows the tune. But it's according to the inspiration of the moment as to how it comes out. You follow me?
Right.
And I do have a plan and a pattern for every show that I do, yes.
Thank you, sir.
One other question, if I may.
All right, sir.
You talk a lot about, Gene, this again for you. You talk a lot about your days in the Army, and you also talk a lot about your childhood, but you hardly ever mention your days in school or in college.
Oh, yes, I do. I quite often talk. In fact, to me, there are certain periods of your life that are more significant than others and are... You see, I'm not trying to do an autobiography on the show. Nor am I trying to do a report on my life on
right.
the show.
Right.
I work on the show really in a sense as a writer works, and I'm curious why James Jones, for example, has never written a story about, let's say, when he went to college, or why Norman Mailer doesn't write about the time that, let's say, he took a trip to Bermuda. The point is that I think that these two areas of a man's life are often more significant, meaningful, and dramatic, really, than other periods.
Right.
Does that answer your question?
Well, in a sense, then, are you saying that you felt your days in college were not particularly significant?
I think that they were less significant than other days, yes.
Mm-hmm. And one other comment I'd like to make. The gentleman who called up about the FM simulcasting.
Yes.
What I am very, very disappointed about is that you've lost the entire market of Boston. See, Gene was on the RKO station up in Boston last year, and they took him off, supposedly, for the summer. However, when the fall came back in the autumn, they didn't put him back on again. And they're running one of these telephone talk programs in his place. And, of course... we have a little difficulty with reception up there receiving New York in Boston.
And from December 24th, 1966, as originally aired on WNBC AM in New York, Gene Shepherd is a guest of Long John Nebel on Sundays with Shep. Now, Shep and Long John Nebel were actually co-workers for a number of years. Nebel began his radio career at WOR in 1954, and worked there until 1962, hosting a late-night talk show, which might have been the inspiration for similar overnight radio shows of later years hosted by Art Bell and George Norrie. Nebel often discussed topics like UFOs, voodoo, witchcraft, hypnotism, conspiracy theories, and ghosts. But as you might have noted in that clip, Nebel was not the most endearing host on radio. His grating, somewhat abrasive, on-air manner was a turnoff to some listeners, but others found it endearing. His abrasive, abrupt style also may have given us radio's first 7-second delay. It seems that management at WOR was a little concerned that some of Nebel's callers or guests may inadvertently utter a swear word on the air. So in 1956, station engineers invented a system which used a modified tape deck with an additional set of heads that gave the engineer enough time to hit the stop button to avoid airing foul language. In 1962, crosstown rival WNBC offered Nebel $100,000 a year, which was quite a hefty sum for a radio personality in those days, to begin broadcasting from their station. He accepted the offer and worked there until 1973, when the station switched to an all-rock format. After leaving WNBC, He went to work at another crosstown rival, WMCA, where he worked until his death in 1978. For a short time in 1977, he was heard nationally on the Mutual Broadcasting System. After Neble died in 1978, his Mutual Network slot was taken over by Larry King. Well, it is Christmas Eve, and for the rest of the program, we're going to feature some Shep stocking stuffers. Out there amongst Shep tape collectors, there are a number of segments of shows and short-form work that Shep did that often doesn't get aired, and we've got a few of those this week. And we're going to start out with a couple of Shep's earliest recordings from his WOR days. And in this first clip, Shep wants to know, what would 20th Century Man be like if he had no outlook? A note about the audio quality, you will hear a little bit of bleed over from an adjacent station on this recording, but actually a little bit of the music in the background tends to enhance Shep's point, ironically. So with that, let's go back to 1958 as originally aired on WOR AM in New York. Gene Shepherd ponders A Man Without an Outlook on Sundays with Shep.
Today, wait till somebody writes the poem of The Man Without an Outlook. You see, this is one of the things that is bugging the average 20th century man. He has no outlook. He has no philosophy. He has no real conclusion that he has ever arrived at about anything. And so there is this incessant and insane kind of drifting off into a sensual pragmatism, which is not really what pragmatism eventually and originally meant. But we go in the direction of a kind of Stanislavski method living, to go with it. You know what the expression in the actor's term means, to go with it? That when you feel something working within you, you go with it, you see. Even though it's wrong, you go with it, because it will be better than the thing which is not coming from within you. In other words, be careful of your mind. Always go with your emotions. We have become emotional people, not logical people. And since we have negated a good deal of the intellect within ourselves, we have to trust to our emotions, which oftentimes are highly untrustworthy. And so I think it would be a great poem, The Man Without an Outlook. And so he sailed and sailed and sailed and sailed. And he looked and he looked and he looked. It looked like any minute now, as he hove into port, that he was going to find it. And then the man stood on the dock and said, no, not here. And with a quiet sigh of resignation, he returned to his humble little cabin in the steerage room and waited for the trip to begin again. The lines were cast off in the long and stormy seas. And he knew he was a man without an outlook, doomed to sail the sea of life forever, searching, searching, searching. So stay tuned, friends. Be the first in your neighborhood to make it. While we're on the subject of what was it? I've forgotten. It really doesn't matter. One more thing. Let's do it before we go. I've got to do it. Yeah, here it is. A Footnote to Tennyson by Gerald Bullett. I feel it when the game is done. I feel it when I suffer most. 'Tis better to have loved and lost than ever to have loved and won. That is so true. Tennyson, you were wrong. Tennyson, you dropped the ball again. I repeat, 'tis better to have loved and lost than ever to have loved and won. I shot an arrow into the air. I don't know how it fell or where, but strangely enough, at my journey's end, I found it again in the neck of a friend. This is Wyndham Lewis, who also has seen that there are things and there are things. And once there are things, oh, man is doomed forever to wander. Neatly put it all together, in its case it lay compacted, folded into nearly nothing. But he pulled out the hinges, pushed and pulled the joints and hinges, till it looked all squares and oblongs, like a complicated figure in the second book of Euclid. This he perched upon a tripod, crouched beneath its dusky cover, stretched his hand, enforcing silence, said he, "Be motionless, I beg you." Mystic, awful was the process. All the family in order sat before him for their pictures each in turn. As he was taken, volunteered his own suggestions, his ingenious suggestions. So, there again, you see, is the always attempt. Now, what you do when you're sitting there in the old rowboat of life, and the oarlocks are creaking? Have you ever felt that you're living, Dick, in a rowboat of life, and everybody else has this beautiful custom cruiser, 38 feet long, and they're going past you with this twin diesel power plant, which is low on fuel consumption, but high on fun return. And you're sitting there rowing. I'm attempting to imitate the sound of a man rowing a boat. That is pretty good. Not bad, see? And not only that, this old rented rowboat with the rusty, dusty oarlocks is a rented rowboat. It don't even own the crummy thing. And like all rowboats, it's made out of that special lead-impregnated wood, which makes it impossible to move. You're rowing your way across the lake where you know there's a special hole where the sunfish always hit at this hour of the day. Past goes this guy in his 38-foot cabin cruiser. And there you are. You're in the wake. Splop, 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 splop. I'm imitating a rowboat caught in the wake. Splop, 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 splop. Crying out loud, these crummy, miserable characters with their motorboats are ruining the fishing around here. Splop, 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 splop. No, no, man. They are not ruining the fishing. They are just fishing for something else that you will never know. While you're there dabbing for mudcats, while you're there fishing for bullheads, trying to catch a small sunfish, these guys are after the big game, boy. Oh, there goes another one. Plop, 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 plop. So don't, never cast, never drop the anchor in the wrong spot. Just keep going. You got that mud hole, Spotted. You got it, Spotted, man. There's nobody going to catch sunfish like you're going to catch. Stay tuned for the Happiness Hour, which follows in just a few moments. A compendium of man's ills, his attempts to make it, his failures. It's a laugh a minute. It's news, yes, world news. The story of the way man is doing it. This is Harold Teen. We'll be back again tomorrow night at 9:05. And the golden key might unlock that vast open door. And don't forget, listen again tomorrow night for the $50,000 Mystery Award.
And from sometime in 1958, Gene Shepherd wonders about what man would be like without an outlook on Sundays with Shep. And in that clip, he read a short poem satirizing Alfred Lord Tennyson written by Gerald Bullitt. Gerald Bullitt had died earlier in 1958. He was a British man of letters, novelist, essayist, short story writer, critic, and poet. He worked for the BBC during World War II and contributed to the Times Literary Supplement. One of his best-known works was Mr. Godley Beside Himself, which was a humorous fantasy story about a modern man who exchanges places with his doppelganger in fairyland. He was a great admirer of Walt Whitman and wrote an essay on Whitman for the book Great Democrats by Alfred Barrett Brown. In it, he described Whitman as a man full-blooded and brotherly, unself-conscious of in his democracy, and genuinely at ease with all kinds and classes. All right, time now for another short from the 1950s, and this one goes back to 1957, and it's one of Shep's most notorious routines, he did it quite often, in which he would do a segment called Hurling Invective. And in it, he would ask his listeners to put their radios in the windowsills, of course with the windows being open, and then he would shout something loud enough so that it would echo throughout the streets and alleys of New York City. I haven't found any contemporary indicators as to how many people actually did this, but you know there had to be a few. So with that, let's go back to sometime in 1957, as originally aired on WOR AM in New York. Gene Shepherd is hurling invective on Sundays with Shep.
Can't speak any WOR, looking at it realistically, has realized that we must, nay, indeed, all of us, you must have an outlet. You must be able to, from time to time, tell them what it's all about. Give it to them. Don't stand still for nobody. Once again, the science of electronics brings deeper and richer meaning to your lives. Put your radio on the windowsill. In an unprecedented act of goodwill towards its listenership, realization of its deep responsibilities as a purveyor of public good, WOR makes this service available to you exclusively. This is the only station where you'll find an outlet for your aggressions. You'll find expressions for your repressions. Put your radio on the windowsill now. Do it now. Now. With the loudspeaker pointed out towards the neighborhood. You know that crowd out there. You know that gang. Of course you do. Put it out there. That's it. And I'll give you a cue. And the WOR Public Service Department stands behind you. It's okay. Nobody will be able to trace it to you. We have a special, non-traceable voice, which we use on this particular invective. It's all right. It will not sound like any living being. Any resemblance to anyone alive at this time is purely coincidental. And does not, of course, include you, since you are obviously not coincidental. Now, the result of forces beyond all comprehension. Millions of tiny forces have led you to this point. Coincidences here and there, yes, but they've all fallen into a pattern, and here you are now. So you're off the hook. This voice will carry your sentiments, your repressions, your aggressions, into the darkness out there, that void where they're lying in wait. Those sharks are waiting. Your friends, yeah, your friends. They're your friends, all right. They're your friends. Anytime you really need them, you know what's going to happen, of course. All right. Get your radio out on the windowsill and point it outwards, and I'll give you the cue. And when I give you the cue, turn that radio up as loudly as it'll go. We're going to use a very special kind of invective tonight. This is known as the disquieting with a touch of morbid curiosity type, which is type 23A and a very difficult type to use. You can drop out now if you feel it's a little too strong. It's the... All right, all ready? Okay. Radio on windowsill now. Lights out, for heaven's sakes, turn your lights out. Turn the radio on now. Turn it up. Pretend that you're looking at television. Pretend you're asleep. Okay?
Myrtle! This is the third time you've come home drunk again! What about the kids? What about the kids, I ask you? How long is this going to go on? How long?
Okay, get that radio back in now, fast. This is the Martin Block program. It's time for make-believe pool room, friends and neighbors. Time to pick up your cues. Time to step over the table and knock off a game of make-believe snooker. And now on table 7, we see Greasy Thumb Goosick racking them up. And over on the... Yes, it's Tiger Eye Smithers.
And from sometime in 1957, as originally aired on WOR AM in New York, Gene Shepherd is hurling invective on Sundays with Shep. Now, it may be an urban legend, but it's worth noting that screenwriter Paddy Chayefsky was a big fan of Shep's. Chayefsky was one of Shep's colleagues as well at the Village Voice. And it's sometimes told that Shep's hurling invective segments were the inspiration for one of the most famous moments in big screen history. When in Chayefsky's movie Network, Peter Finch's character Howard Beale implores all of his viewers to go to their windows, open them, and yell, "I'm as mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore." Now, although that claim has never really been proven, it's fun to try and make the connection, I guess. Now, after Shep retired from WOR in 1977 to focus more on writing screenplays, he signed on with the CBS radio network to contribute a series of short commentaries to their affiliated stations. It's not known how many of them Shep actually recorded, but 25 of them have been discovered and posted at flicklives.com, and we're going to share a few of those with you this week. Sometimes the topics were contemporary to the day, other times they were rehashes of some of Shep's topics that he addressed in his shows years before. And in this first one, he takes a look at the phenomenon of calling up somebody for information about just about anything. So let's go back to 1977, as originally aired on the CBS radio network. Gene Shepherd has some ideas for new dial-up services on Sundays with Shep.
Hey, have you ever dialed one of these things, you know, that they advertise like a dial-a-gag? Have you ever actually done it? You have. Well, I bet you're sorry. Have you ever seen the ones that say dial a prayer? Well, there have been times when I've been tempted by that one, especially at 3 o'clock in the morning when all the world looks like Fitzgerald's world, F. Scott Fitzgerald, that said the whole world was composed of a vast attic where people were moving old furniture around. You know that kind of night. Well, you can dial a friend now in most major cities. Oh, yes. In fact, for guys that are fired, there is now a new service that's been breaking out in Chicago called Dial a Boss. If you are out of work, one of the worst problems of being out of work, of course, is that you have no authority figure in your life anymore. And you just sit around a house and watch daytime TV, which could be worse than going to, you know, Alcatraz. And so every once in a while, you dial a boss, and he yells at you. It costs you $4 a month. And he tells you to get your files straight. Now, the best of them all has happened, and this is a fact. A toll-free number you can call now to dial an obscene phone call. I wonder how they audition people to give the, you know, the obscene phone calls. Well, it costs you $19 a month, and you can get all types of obscene phone calls. You can get softcore, hardcore, or the kind you get arrested for, depending on how much you want to pay. And by the way, they guarantee to call you at all hours of the day and night, like a true obscene phone call. So it's 4 o'clock in the morning, the phone rings, you jump up and you answer it, and some guy from Omaha is giving you the business. So friends, life is moving forward, and we have a lot to thank Ma Bell for. This is Gene Shepherd on his knees in thanks.
And from sometime between 1977 and 1979, as originally aired on the CBS radio network, Gene Shepherd ponders some new phone services for people seeking more than the time and temperature. Okay, now in the next one, Shep focuses on a topic that he discussed from time to time during his radio show, and that is his fascination with 20th century myths. And one of these topics may be familiar, as he often talked about the search for that one piece of chewing gum that could lead to a new car parked in the garage. So let's go back to around 1977 through 1979, as originally aired on the CBS radio network in New York. Gene Shepherd has some 20th century myths on Sundays with Shep.
We're back again with one of our famous enduring 20th century myths. Now, as all of you know, I pointed out recently that some people collect stamps, other people collect Ming China. Well, I collect enduring 20th century myths, and I must admit this one I was definitely a victim of myself. I went home to visit my mother and my father, the old folks, you know, and I went down in the basement. This was recently. And under the basement stairs, I found a gunny sack full of my past follies. I had a gunny sack filled with Wrigley Spearmint gum wrappers. Because at one time there was a myth, if you got a gum wrapper with the right number inside of it and you sent it into the Wrigley Company, you could win probably the Empire State Building. Well, my old man believed that if you got a Model A Ford in the right condition and took it down to the Ford dealer, he'd give you a new Lincoln Continental for it. Have you ever heard that one? Of course, all of these American myths are continuing, and there are people who still believe if they took the Model A down there, they'd get a new Ford or a new Pinto for it. Try it someday. Try collecting, old gold cigarette wrappers, because inside is a number, which if properly numbered, properly figured out, you'd probably win your lifetime vacation in Bermuda. These are all myths, American myths, and they never stop. Let me tell you the one about Campbell's soup, but I don't have the time. I'll be back. This is Gene Shepherd, who incidentally is a myth himself.
And from 1977-ish, as originally aired on the CBS radio network, Gene Shepherd with some 20th century myths on Sundays with Shep. And by the way, that was an urban legend. There was no contest if you found the right number on a Wrigley's gum wrapper that you could get a new Ford. But people did believe that for many, many years, and actually Wrigley's would often have to write back to people sending them gum wrappers that it was a bogus contest and please stop sending them gum wrappers. Now in this next one, Shep shows a little bit of his sports fanaticism as he salutes a Cleveland Indians fan who must have been a season ticket holder and pulled off an incredible feat, considering at the time the Indians were playing in the cavernous Municipal Stadium. So let's go back once again to 1977-ish, as originally aired on the CBS radio network. Gene Shepherd has a salute to sportsmen on Sundays with Shep.
Listen, I'd like to take the time now to really give a salute to what I consider one of the great American sportsmen. You know, there's never been a nation as crazy about sports as we are today. I mean, people are going bananas about everything. I mean, running. Eventually, there's going to be endurance sitting. Guys will prepare for that. They'll buy special chairs to sit in, and they'll be sold at Abercrombie and Fitch. Sports has just taken over like every... People are crazy about sports. And yet, the true sportsmen of our time are not truly honored. I would like to honor a man whose name, by the way, he wishes to keep anonymous. He is a school teacher in the city of Cleveland. Now, if he hears this, he'll know who we're talking about. Last season, this school teacher, equipped with a $16 Japanese fielder's mitt, went to the Cleveland Indians ball games and collected 147 foul balls. That is a fantastic record. Do you know that I've been going to baseball games ever since I was 9 and have not gotten within 40 feet of a foul ball? One foul ball. And the great ambition of every ball fan is to get a ball. I actually have 147 in one season. Do you realize this surpasses anything that any of the pitchers in the major leagues did last year. A great achievement. Well, let's see. I almost got a football once at Giant Stadium. You know, out here, I'm walking with a tray of hot dogs. Seriously, I had a tray of hot dogs. I had a big can of coffee, and I'm walking through the crowd when all of a sudden I got hit between the shoulder blades by a Garo Yepremian kick. I didn't get the ball, but I sure as heck got the coffee right in my mouth. This is Gene Shepherd, and I always carry a fielder's mitt with me at all times. You never know when they're going to foul tip one at you.
And from 1977-ish, as originally aired on the CBS radio network and distributed to their affiliates across the country, Gene Shepherd with a salute to sportsmen on Sundays with Shep. And that Cleveland Indians fanatic certainly did want to remain anonymous, because I could not find any record of a man catching 147 foul balls in the same season at Cleveland Municipal Stadium around the year 1977. However, there was a report in 2013 of a guy who caught 4 foul balls in the same game at Progressive Field, so hats off to him as well. Now, it's the age-old question if you're a clothes hoarder. Are you ever going to wear any of that stuff in your closet? How much of that do you actually wear? Well, Gene Shepherd believes that in thousands of years, when future archaeologists come to investigate our modern society, they're going to think we had way too many clothes. Let's go back to 1977, as originally aired on the CBS radio network. Gene Shepherd looks in the closet on Sundays with Shep.
Hey, did you ever look in the closet of all, you know, your closet. I'm talking about your clothes closet, see? And it, you've got a jam full of stuff. And it goes all the way to the back. And in fact, it's so filled that in the back now, you've forgotten what's in the back there. There's just dark stuff back there. And if you ever got back there, there'd be, oh, who knows what? You know, things would reach out and grab you with suckers on their feelers. I mean, you just don't go in that closet anymore. Well, the question that I want to bring up here at this point is, have you ever looked at all your stuff in your closet and wondered what you saw in it? Why you bought this? What made you think that that turtleneck shirt with the V-neck, the one with the little squirrel on the sleeves, what made you think that was great looking? I mean, have you ever wondered about that? Have you ever taken a look at old pictures of yourself, even taken, say, 5, 6, 8, 9 years ago, and you wonder, why did I wear that? Look at that coat. Look at those stupid pants. What the heck is all that about? Well, I have a theory about that, as I have a theory about everything. I think that discontent is built into the human mind. You will always be discontented with what you did yesterday. And it's especially noticeable in clothing. I think eventually, when the dust has settled on our time, when the 20th century has disappeared into the vast canyons of time, just like the days of the pharaohs, they will look upon our age as the age of clothing. There's going to be great, great drifts of clothing found under the alluvial ash. Great thick drifts of vinyl skirts and jogging shoes. Fancy sweat socks and thousands of shirts. Millions of pairs of corduroy pants. And endless, endless things. And they'll wonder why we wore them and what we were trying to prove. Nobody knows. Certainly I don't. I have got closets that have over 30, 40,000 garments in them. And actually, I've only got two things that I ever wear. It'll never end. This is Gene Shepherd, hoping that one day they'll come back with armor.
And once again, from 1977-ish, as originally aired on the CBS Radio Network and distributed to their affiliated stations throughout the country, Gene Shepherd takes a look in the closet on Sundays with Shep. And if archaeologists are looking through the closets of today, they may notice a few items from Abercrombie and Fitch. And while the name of that store has been around for more than a century, it wasn't founded as a trendy clothing retailer. And in this next short, Gene Shepherd reminisces about some of the things that could be found at Abercrombie & Fitch in its early days. So with that, let's go back to 1977, as originally aired on the CBS Radio Network. Gene Shepherd remembers Abercrombie & Fitch on Sundays with Shep.
You know, I'll tell you, I must say that I'm in a little state of disarray today. Abercrombie & Fitch is no longer with us here in New York as such. And that is really, to me, depressing. Abercrombie & Fitch. Now, all these people who keep talking about what's happening to New York, I suspect they haven't even noticed that some of the great things in New York and have made New York what New York always was, a place of fantastic, overwhelming style, have slowly, on cat's feet, crept away from the world we know. Now, why Abercrombie & Fitch? Abercrombie & Fitch goes back almost 100 years. I mean, F. Scott Fitzgerald strode through the halls of Abercrombie & Fitch looking for a decent tweed coat. Hemingway went to Abercrombie & Fitch to pick up another one of those pith helmets you wear when you're in Africa. And when he put it on his head, he shouted, "Fully!" Oh, that's Abercrombie & Fitch. That's not Gino's Burger Palace. And it slowly crept out of town. And what's it replaced by? Bloomingdale's. I'll tell you, there's a world of difference between style and fashion. We're a world of fashion today, and fashion is ever-changing. And not only that, it's self-destruct. What's today's fashion is tomorrow's joke. But Abercrombie & Fitch was pure style. Something died in New York when Mr. Abercrombie and Mr. Fitch's great store finally departed. I, for one, will weep its departure. This is Gene Shepherd. Well, I guess it's inevitable.
And from 1977, as originally aired on the CBS radio network and distributed to its affiliated stations, Gene Shepherd with The Demise of Abercrombie and Fitch on Sundays with Shep. Now, Abercrombie and Fitch was founded in June of 1892 in Manhattan as an elite outfitter of sporting and excursion goods. It sold expensive shotguns, fishing rods, fishing boats, tents. Society's upper crust, who also liked to practice adventuring in the outdoors, were seen with Abercrombie and Fitch goods, especially the Kennedys. But the call for high-end sporting goods fell off in the 1970s, and in 1977, when Shep recorded this segment, Abercrombie & Fitch had recently filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy and closed its flagship store at Madison Avenue and East 45th Street in Manhattan. It wasn't gone for long, though, at least the name, because in 1978, Oshman Sporting Goods, which was based out of Houston, Texas, purchased the Abercrombie & Fitch name and revived it as a mail-order company specializing in hunting wear and novelty items. It opened a few specialty stores in Beverly Hills, Dallas, and New York City, and in 1988, Oshman sold the company name and operations to The Limited, a clothing chain operator based in Columbus, Ohio, which evolved Abercrombie & Fitch from the sporting goods store to the apparel retailer that we know today. And since that time, Abercrombie & Fitch has weathered a wave of ups and downs, both ethically and financially, probably best known in the 90s for controversial catalogs featuring scantily clad young models, ironically in an effort to try and sell clothes. Recently, it started to succumb to the decline of brick-and-mortar retailers, and over the past several years, it has closed dozens of its stores throughout the country. The store, by the way, is no longer headquartered in New York. Its home office is in New Albany, Ohio. And for some reason, I don't think Shep would wax as poetically about the closings of Abercrombie & Fitch today as he did back in 1977. All right, one more of these CBS segments. And in this one, Shep reaches into his mailbag and finds something ominous, like he's seen it in a movie before. With that, let's go back to 1977-ish, as originally aired on the CBS radio network. Gene Shepherd has some mysterious mail on Sundays with Shep.
Hey, listen, I had a terrible thing happen to me the other day. I don't know quite how to say this, but it was a real bad scene. How many of you are fans of the old Charlie Chan movies? You remember Warner Oland, Charlie Chan? And he didn't look Chinese. Well, you know, it's hard to say. He had that white hat on. He always wore that Panama hat. And his secretary was always Roquel Hudson. This is a movie star. And I remember one scene when Charlie Chan was sitting in his office when Roquel Hudson, or was it Roquel? Roquel Hudson came in with the mail. I mean, you don't think of Charlie Chan getting the morning mail, but he did in this scene. And he opened the mail up, and he says, what? He says, ah, mysterious envelope. And he opens up the envelope, says, ah, so. And out of the envelope tumbled one thing. Was it a letter? It was the Ace of Spades. And you knew immediately that Charlie Chan was in bad trouble. This morning, I am going through my usual drift of junk mail. Offers of $300 on my signature only. Fantastic offers from the Time Life Company of a 7,000 volume bound in Morocco leather. Copies of the Sanskrit transcription of the history of the world. Various other things that I need. When all of a sudden I opened the mysterious envelope and out dropped the Ace of Spades. Somebody out there is after me, and you're not going to get away with it.
And from 1977-ish, as originally aired on the CBS radio network and distributed to its affiliated stations throughout the country, Gene Shepherd talks about some of the mysterious mail he's received on Sundays with Shep. Well, now we're going to turn from radio to television. And in 1977, Shep produced the second of a series of television programs for public broadcasting. A few years earlier, he worked with WGBH in Boston to produce Gene Shepherd's America, That series ran for 13 episodes in 1971. A second series was commissioned in 1985, producing 10 new shows along with encores of three shows from the first series. In 1977, though, Shep hosted a program for WNJM, New Jersey Public Television, called Shepherd's Pie. According to FlickLives.com, there were 26 episodes of Shepherd's Pie, which covered two seasons. And Shepherd's Pie often covered some of the topics that Shep talked about in his radio program, including his love of music and one song in particular, as witnessed in the next audio clip. So with that, let's go back to January 31st, 1978, as originally aired on WNJM Television in New Jersey. It's The Bear Missed the Train on Sundays with Shep.
Vaudeville, a disappearing creature. In the Orpheum Pantages, a theater here in New Jersey, they still do vaudeville, and vaudeville freaks come from all over the world just to watch these old guys do their thing. They've allowed our cameras inside. Here is a little peek.
The bear missed the train.
Sorry you caught me there laughing there. I shouldn't do that. Watching that, you know why vaudeville died, don't you? That was taken direct from the stage of the historic Orpheum Pantages, where vaudeville is not dead, but is barely breathing. And they're very careful. They don't want us to tell where their location is. They just don't want to be inundated with smart guys.
And from January 31st, 1978, as originally aired on Shepherd's Pie, a production of WNJM Television in New Jersey, Gene Shepherd with The Bear Missed the Train on Sundays with Shep. And that will do it for this week's edition of Sundays with Shep. As always, we appreciate your feedback. You can drop us an email with your questions, comments, maybe your memories of Shep. The email address is sundayswithshep@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com and search for Sundays with Shep. Give us a like, and then you'll get access to show previews, Shep-related trivia, and the chance to interact with other fatheads around the world. And if you'd like to hear this or previous editions of Sundays with Shep one more time, you can find podcasts on our show page. That's at lakeshorepublicradio.org. Just click on the Programs tab at the top of the page and scroll down to Sundays with Shep to catch up on some of the shows you might have missed. Coming up next week, Shep takes a look back at the previous year. Until that time, I'm Ryan Priest. For everyone here at Lakeshore Public Radio, Thanks for spending part of your Sunday with us. Have a great Christmas, and we hope to have you back here next Sunday with Shep.
Thank you.